The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day one of a new year and a new sesshin, the first sesshin in 2018 here at Mountain Gate. It's January 4th. And we will continue our deep practice as usual. It's especially helpful to have these sesshin, particularly so close together. We've had October, November, Rohatsu, and almost immediately after that, with a little break for vacation, the January sesshin, and February we'll be going to Hidden Valley Zen Center in Southern California to do sesshin there, and then there will be sesshin here again right after that, still in February. And so it goes. Life is so short, and that the depths that we can reach in our meditation, in our Zazen, are incomparable. And it's important to do that before we die. To that end, there's a new book out called Altered Traits. Science Reveals How Meditation Changes Your Mind, Brain, and Body. It's an excellent book put together by a couple of long-term meditators, one Vipassana, the other Tibetan Buddhist meditator. Daniel Goleman is a big name in psychology as well as in Zazen. And Rich Davidson, who runs a lab at the University of Wisconsin that has recently, well, not so recently, several years ago, did a vital study researching the effects of meditation in working with children, kindergarten children, and also with traumatized veterans. And in only 1 week, there were amazing changes, both in the little kids and in the veterans. What Daniel and Richie, as he's known, are dead set in favor of is deep enough meditation that it actually alters our mind, body, and brain. There's plenty of relatively superficial meditation out there, and through it you can get some relief from stress. You can develop some nice traits, but what they're seeking and what we are seeking here at Mountain Gate and also at Hidden Valley Zen Center is a deep level of meditation that is actually transformative, and not just temporarily transformative, but permanently transformative. And to that end, let me quote one of the comments in the book. You've got a couple of comments. What happened to the other one? Did it disappear? Oh, I think it didn't. All right. In the time of Gautama Buddha, full concentrated absorption in samadhi was heralded as the highway to liberation for yogis. Legend has it that the Buddha practiced this approach with a group of wandering ascetics, but he abandoned that avenue and discovered an innovative variety of meditation looking deeply into the mechanics of consciousness itself. Jhana, which is absorption, alone, the Buddha is said to have declared, was not the path to a liberated mind. Though strong concentration can be an enormous aid along the way, the Buddha's path veers into a different kind of inner focus, the path of insight. Here, awareness stays open to whatever arises in the mind rather than to one thing only, to the exclusion of all else, as in total concentration. The ability to maintain this mindfulness, an alert but non-reactive stance in attention, varies with our powers of one-pointedness. With mindfulness, the meditator simply notes without reactivity whatever comes into mind, such as thoughts or sensory impressions like sounds, and lets them go. The operative word here is go. If we think much about anything that just arose, or let it trigger any reactivity at all, we've lost our mindful stance, unless that reaction or thought in turn becomes the object of mindfulness. And we offer a variation of this deep practice here. And let me give you another quote. The original aim of meditation, embraced by some circles to this day, focuses on a deep exploration of the mind toward a profound alteration of our very being. Toward a profound alteration of our very being. As we deepen our practice, we see more and more where we're caught in, essentially, greed, anger, and delusion, but as a result of being deeply invested in a self-image. And this self-image is a sham. We take it as the real self, and it's not. It's not who we are at all. It's an accumulation of our assumptions about our conditioning, the things that happened to us and the conclusions we drew from those things that happened to us. And it all develops into a kind of a web of personality, an image of who we are, and we take that to be solid and real, and it's neither. All it is a set of stories based on our own conclusions, and many of these things happened that define our self-image when we were children. Children learn through the responses of adults around us, and then later in peer groups with the responses of their peers. Well, if you ever watched The Lord of Flies, that can be pretty dicey and pretty crazy, and not at all about who we really are. So if we're not this fabrication of stories, then who are we? What are we? As we delve deeply into our practice through concentration and insight, we begin to get hints about what's true and what's not true. And we begin to be able to let go those assumptions of who we are and see something greater. Before that happens, often what happens first is, as we begin to let go, fear comes up. Because if we're not this person we think we are, then what? Are we going to go crazy? Are we going to disappear? What's going to happen? How are we going to figure out how to interact in society? Well, there's a built-in sense of ethics, of honesty, of clarity, of compassion, of profound wisdom. It tends to be a little overridden by this self-image and the assumptions that it gives to us. But as that self-image begins to thin out, and first, of course, there is, like I said, that period of time where fear comes up, because we're not sure whether we want to let go that hold on the cliff that seems so safe and let ourselves drop into what has been described as a fiery abyss, but that's only the assumption of it. It's not that it is fiery. It is called, however, the Great Death, because it's a dying to who we think we are. And it's absolutely essential for any level of permanent altered traits. I think there's another quote in here. Let's see if we can get to it. This is under a chapter called The Deep Path and the Wide. An altered trait, a new characteristic that arises from a meditation practice, endures apart from meditation itself. Altered traits shape how we behave in our lives, not just immediately after we meditate. And it's, I think pretty much everybody has experienced the ease that can come at the end of right after a 7-day sesshin. But that's not what they're talking about. What they're talking about is a permanent change in our assumptions about ourselves, a letting go that allows us to live at a much deeper, much more authentic level. Of course, there's a lot of work to do along the way. And if we've been traumatized, there's a huge amount of work, but it's manageable. It can be done. People here have done a great deal of work in that direction and brought themselves to a certain level of freedom. We can always go deeper. We can always go deeper. This deep path in the wide is a discussion about the different ways of meditating and the different aims for the wide path. There are many people that are interested in that. That's a certain level of meditation that will give you some ease in your life. It won't be transformative necessarily. The deep path is transformative. And it's vital. Our world is in such a crazy place these days. We've just gotten the news a couple of days ago that the person who's the head of this country has tweeted an extremely aggressive, belligerent tweet to another country that also has a head that's extremely belligerent and it's really a terrible, terrible conditions in that country. And it could bring us right to a nuclear war. This is what we have standing at our backs. When somebody asked in anguish, Yasutani Roshi, many decades ago in Japan, about war and death, and his response was, well, if an atom bomb came, you would perforce become one with it. So when we stand outside and experience that the problems exist. And that's exactly where we want to stand usually, because we're afraid of walking into whatever the experience is. And yet, as Kepler Rishi said so many years ago and so many times actually, the way in is the way out. When we allow ourselves to focus on the experience of the out-breath, and this is the physical experience of the out-breath. At the same time, there is this wordless questioning, this openness to possibility that maybe what we think is not all there is, or maybe it's not even true at all. As we do that, not only do we have an inner focus that requires that we let go other stuff, thoughts, ideas, all that kind of thing that usually has a constant parade in our mind. And at the same time, it's as if there's an expansion of awareness, a clear awareness that allows us to recognize how we're caught. Sometimes it can take a while. But if we persist, it will happen. And as we persist, little by little, we walk into liberation. But we really have to persist for that to happen. And then we can't just, as Kapler-Roshi thought he would do, get Kensho and run. Happily, he didn't. He stuck it out in Japan for 13 more years of intensive practice before returning to the States and sharing what he had learned, what he had understood, and becoming an exemplary teacher despite what some people have thought. There's another book that's just recently come out. It's called Unbinding: The Grace Beyond Self, meaning the self-image. And it's by a woman, Kathleen Dowling Singh, who has authored a number of Grace of different books, The Grace of Dying, The Grace of Aging, and so on. She herself just recently died, and apparently it was an amazingly peaceful death. And if you read this book, you will see that she's quite a let-go person. Unbinding is an excellent title. It's exactly what we're doing as we're doing our Zazen. We're unbinding ourselves from this self-binding that we've done all of our life, actually all of our lifetimes, because of this conditioning. Something happens, we get an assumption about it. Well, is that really true? Most likely it's not. And it's also important to recognize that, contrary to Christianity, Buddhism does not talk about original sin. They talk about original perfection. Innately, we are endowed with compassion and wisdom, with a sense of ethics, with an ability to empathize with other human beings and animals and trees and whatever. And it's only because of these conditioned experiences that we've had from the very beginning that we fail to perceive it. And that's basically what the Buddha said, or is said to have said, as he had his profound awakening experience in Bodhgaya at the end of his, what is now modeled for the Rohatsu Sesshin, eighth day, eighth morning of sitting, when he glanced up at the evening star, or the morning star, I should say, and it all fell away, and he saw profoundly clearly the nature of the universe and the nature of his own being. And he said, supposedly, "Wonder of wonders, all beings are endowed with this mind of great perfection, lacking nothing. But because the minds of men and women are turned upside down through delusive thinking, they fail to perceive it." It's kind of odd, but it's so incredibly common that we are so deeply invested in this self-image. Perhaps because if we're not somebody, as we said earlier in this Teisho, are we going to disappear? Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am." And he was really onto something there. But what is this I? Who is this one that is? And is it a false image? Or is it the true reality? What is the true reality of our being? This is what we are here to explore. Giving ourselves deep absorption into the experience of this out-breath. We're having to search beyond words, because it cannot be found in thought. It cannot be found through words. All we can do is point to something with words. There's a vast difference between words and what really is. And what really is what will liberate us, not the words. We can tell ourselves all kinds of things. We can hear all kinds of things. We can hear a million times that we're perfect, whole, and complete. But if our self-image tells us something different, we won't be able to believe it. It won't become real for us. And the only way for it to become real is to give ourselves relentlessly to this deep practice. Deep practice. Deeper than we can imagine practice. Because that not only gets results, but we are transformed by it more than just momentarily. A Kensho experience is a brief glimpse into some level of reality. And I say some level because it's not necessarily the deepest level. But it's usually fleeting. It may last a few days, a few weeks, a few months, even a few years. But like the man who went to see Kapiloroshi 10 years after he had been in the invasion of Normandy, survived, came back to New York City, and was so caught in this profound questioning of why? Why can there be so much suffering? Why can people do these things to each other? Why does it have to happen? That he couldn't do anything but wander the streets, totally absorbed in that question. And after 6 months, it broke open for him. But it wasn't sufficiently deep to last as long as Flora Courtois' deep awakening did. 20 years for her until she encountered, actually it was more than 20 years. It was 20 years between the awakening experience and when she met Yastani Roshi. And by then she was doing Zazen with Mayazumi, and Yastani Roshi, on hearing her story and seeing her and meeting her, he had quite a chance to meet her because she drove him and some other priests all the way from LA to San Francisco, which is not a quick drive, certainly not in those days. And he said he felt it was not necessary to test her because it was very clear to him that that awakening experience was still functioning in her life. And that's what it needs to do. It needs to function in our life. It needs to be transformative. And this is why it's important to recognize that a single Kensho, 2 Kensho, 10 Kensho, 15 Kensho, however many, is not sufficient. Hakuin, the great Zen master who single-handedly resurrected Rinzai Zen in 18th century Japan, wrote that he had 19 major Kensho experiences, and it wasn't until the last one that he felt lasting peace. And the first one, he thought, was the most amazing deep Kensho experience anybody had had in 300 years. This underscores the importance of working with a teacher. The bottom line, though, is that total transformation, total freedom, total liberation, total unbinding is within our hands. We have the tools, we have the environment, we have a teacher. What remains is to give ourselves so completely in these 7 days that a great depth is reached, and then to continue on deepening. I think that's enough for a day. Thank you for listening. Stop now and recite the four vows.